From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The 2004 election has come and gone, but the battle of the ballot box is still raging on the Internet. Allegations of irregularities in key states like Florida and Ohio are reinforcing doubts among the doubters, even though Republican and Democratic leaders say it's over, settled. But even Americans ready to move on might be forgiven some unease about the patchwork way the country votes and counts its votes. Red and blue Americans alike were clamoring for a system fix after the agony of Florida in 2000. Relief seemed to be on the way with the Help America Vote Act of 2002. But touchscreen machines with no paper trail and exit polls wildly off the vote have many people groaning all over again. If the election had been a little closer, we could have had an ugly crisis on our hands. Tonight on Point, the integrity of last week's presidential polling and the health of the American voting system. You can join the conversation tonight. Did you go into last week's vote afraid that polling failures could lead to a disputed outcome? Shouldn't the United States of America be able to mount unquestionably fair and clean elections? And what kind of crisis are we flirting with if Americans don't trust their own collective vote? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from San Francisco is Farhad Manju, reporter for Salon.com. He began raising flags about potential voting problems after the 2002 elections. Farhad, welcome. Here we are after the 2004 elections. What were you warning of this time, and what do you see out there?
Well, I've been warning, not me, but I've been talking to many of the activists and computer scientists over the past couple of years who say that we can't trust paperless electronic voting machines. And this has become sort of a movement in the past, more recently. And many people were concerned this year about, because a third of all the voters or so were going to be using these machines. After the election, it's not exactly clear yet what happened. We don't know what happened, whether those machines worked, whether the tally that they give us is accurate. And in some small instances, we've seen the votes not being recorded well. There was a place in Ohio that accidentally, it appears, gave George Bush 4,000 more votes than he won in that precinct. So there are some small instances like that, but by and large, we've seen no evidence of what the computer scientists and other activists have been most concerned about, which is kind of a systematic hacking of the machine to give one candidate or the other the election. We've seen no evidence of that at all. The caveat to that is that if it was done well, we would see no evidence.
Right, which is exactly what worries people. And we're going to come back and look at that. I wish you could take us kind of across the boardwalk, if you can, Farhad, of these allegations that are now all over the web about last week's vote. Both parties saying, no, we're not contesting this. George Bush won, that's that. But it's not going down that easily. What are people pointing to?
Okay, so one of the things they're pointing to, in fact, what's interesting about all of the allegations on the Internet so far is that few of them are about the electronic voting machines, and many point to other kinds of voting machines. One has to do with the punch card voting machines used in most places in Ohio. And the journalist Greg Pallast, who's kind of a muckraking journalist, he noted that there are many places in Ohio where many ballots weren't counted because they were spoiled. Either the chads weren't punched through all the way, the same problems that we saw in Florida in 2000.
And we're talking about quite a few ballots here, 92,000 some.
Right.
But, of course, George Bush won by, 136,000?
Yes, that's right. So it's important to realize that even if every single one of those was deemed a legal ballot and every single one of those was given to Kerry, both very unlikely scenarios, he still couldn't win the election.
But then there's the other 155,000 provisional ballots that haven't been counted in Ohio.
Provisional ballots are the ones where somebody goes to the polls and their names aren't found on the registration rolls, and so they vote on this provisional ballot. And they decide later whether they're going to – the elections officials decide later whether the ballot's going to count or not. Now, nobody thinks that a lot of those are going to count because – one of the reasons you vote on a provisional ballot is your name's not found on the list, and it's probably not found on the list for a real reason, like you're not registered to vote in that area, or you're not registered to vote at all, or something like that. So it's looking at both the provisional as well as the spoiled, discarded ballots, counting them together. It's very unlikely that a great many of them will both be determined to be legal as well as legal carry votes.
So clearly, you're reporting, and we hear from the carry camp. I mean, we heard it, within 24 hours of less than that, at the end of voting.
Right.
They didn't think that Bush lead could have been overcome in Ohio, even though that was the prize for them. If that had been turned around, that would turn around the election.
Right. It's inconceivable. I mean, the Kerry people knew about this the day after the election. They knew about the spoiled ballots as well as the provisional ballots. And if they thought that there was any chance that they could win, I'm sure they would have contested it. But it's rather impossible that they could have won with these numbers.
And then we see brought up all over the place, Farhad, this the charge that you've got too many Bush votes for the number of Republicans in different voting districts, particularly in Florida. We're hearing this.
Right. There are many counties in Florida that use these optical scan voting machines, and somebody did an analysis of the counties that use optical scan voting machines. These are the ones where you actually fill out your selection on paper, and then it's counted by a machine.
Mm-hmm.
And they determined that in many counties where there were lots of registered Democrats, Bush won those counties, and many people think that that's unusual or unreasonable because across the nation, most Republicans voted for Bush and most Democrats voted for Kerry, and it's
right.
Unreasonable to think that all these Democrats in these places would have voted for Bush. But it turns out, if you look at past voting behavior in these counties, it turns out this is not very unusual at all. In 2000, many of these places, the overwhelming number of these counties, even though they have many Democrats in them, they also voted for Bush. And that also happened in 96 and 92. So it seems that these are what political scientists called Dixiecrats, people who are registered as Democrats and who probably vote for Democratic candidates in local elections. But when it comes to the presidency, they most likely vote for Republicans.
And then, Farhad, there's this big overarching issue that, as everybody has heard by now, early afternoon, late afternoon on voting day, the exit polls were saying Kerry by a huge margin in state after state after state. And then, of course, many of those results did not turn out at all. And people are saying maybe it wasn't the exit polls that are wrong. Maybe it was the polls themselves somehow.
This is the hardest one to talk about because what people don't realize is that what we thought we knew about the exit polls on election day was basically based on leaks from internet sites and things like that. We don't actually know what the exit poll said on election day.
Well, why not? I mean, people pay for that polling information. That we don't know it now, all these days later?
The news agencies have the raw data, but none of them have released any of the raw data. The standard procedure for exit polls is on election night, they reweight the polls basically to match the actual results. So we don't know what the polls were saying on election day.
Well, I still don't understand that the news agencies are not in the business of secrecy. If the news agencies know, why isn't it in the news?
Well, that's a good point. At the moment, the company that conducted the polls is basically investigating what happened to the polls. And they won't say what the polls showed during the day. The news agencies, they told me, it's important to realize that Kerry wasn't ahead by such huge margins that any of the news agencies felt comfortable calling any key states for Kerry. In the national popular vote, Kerry at most led by about 2 percentage points, which was well within the margin of error.
Mm.
So it's nothing that, although it gave Democrats reason to be happy that day, it's nothing that anyone was sort of counting on, or the polls did not point to a guaranteed John Kerry win.
But happy, to say the least, the people were almost celebrating in the Kerry camp,
right.
And some very long faces in the Bush camp, and then it all turned around. People are still adjusting to that. We're going to look at that in the bigger picture of what's going on with the health of the American voting system. Farhad Manjoo, thanks for getting us off to a great start tonight.
Thank you.
Farhad Manjoo, writer for Salon.com. I am joined in the studio now by Stephen Ansola-Beher. He is professor of political science at MIT. He's co-director of the Caltech MIT Voter Technology Project. Stephen, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
And also with me in the studio, Heather Gerken. She is assistant professor of law at Harvard Law School, a specialist on voting rights and election law. Heather, thanks a lot for being here.
Nice to be here.
All right, so you've heard this litany of complaints that Farhad just unfolded for us, and I'm sure you've seen there are many more on the web, and headlines on the web saying Kerry wins, and demands on the web saying Kerry must unconcede, take it back, contest the election. The Democrats clearly are not doing that, which would lead one to suspect that at bottom these are not justified complaints. And yet there's a climate in this country that makes people really turn their heads, scratch their heads, wonder and worry that even if it wasn't so far off or wasn't off at all this time, it could have been. And that is deeply unsettling. Are people right to be worried about that, Heather?
I think people are right to think that this is not an election system that works perfectly and to be suspicious of it. There are many problems that we have that were not fixed since 2000, despite efforts at reform. And so the intuition people have that the election system is a little bit creaky, that there's too much play in the joints, is a correct one. The problem is when you add that to a highly partisan environment, what it ultimately means is even when someone actually does win a majority of the vote, even when they win a mandate, that mandate can evaporate pretty quickly because the other side just doesn't think they got beat fair and square. And that's a real problem for the long-term health of our democracy.
Stephen, in this election, most Americans seem to be accepting that 155,000 vote lead of George Bush's in Ohio was sufficiently convincing that they're going along with this. But when you do the math and you see the punch ballots that didn't work and the provisional ballots, I mean, if it had been some fraction smaller, this would have been a wide open issue tonight.
Yeah, if it had been a little bit closer, I think we would be in Ohio counting and contesting.
It's a scary scenario when you imagine, you see how deeply divided the nation is, you see what the perceived stakes of this election were. I mean, someone could just be asserting victory. I mean, it looks like a recipe for chaos.
Yeah, the experience with provisional ballots in Los Angeles County is that about two-thirds are valid.
Two-thirds? So that's
two-thirds.
Not so small.
The question would be what the rules would be for counting those ballots in Ohio. And that's what the litigation was leading up to the election. We were hearing that in the press in the days before, and people were really prepared to litigate.
I mean, for ballot-by-ballot battles over, is this clearly for Bush, or did this voter deserve to vote?
County by county, because in Ohio, the counties were given a lot of discretion about how to count those ballots. And one of the fundamental problems in the system is that there's a real conflict of interest because these county boards are usually elected.
Of course, so they're partisan.
They're partisan.
By definition.
You start there. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the allegations in Florida with Teresa Lepore and Catherine Harris were people playing partisan electoral politics, and that's not gone away.
Let me ask you this. You were a consultant to the National Commission on Federal Election Reform, the so-called Ford-Carter Commission that came after 2000. You've paid a lot of attention to this. Sitting here tonight, Are you 100% confident that Americans have been told, that we've got the right president, that George Bush won fully and legitimately?
Yes.
No doubt about it. This is comforting.
I have no doubt about this.
So when you look at the numbers in Ohio,
Had it been 25,000 votes with this many provisional ballots, then there would be questions.
And Heather Gerken, for all the concerns you raise about the creakiness in the system, as you sit here tonight, same question, fair and square, straight up, did George Bush win?
Absolutely. I have not seen any evidence that would convince me that the election was stolen. I think these allegations are serious, and we ought to investigate them and take them seriously. But I have to agree with Steve that I have not yet seen anything that would convince me that there was a problem in the election that went that deep.
But there are scenarios we can so easily imagine where we would just be in a heck of a mess here tonight as a country.
Oh, absolutely. I think we dodged a bullet. I don't know an election law professor who couldn't have mapped out 7 or 8 scenarios in which we'd have ongoing litigation in 4 states on a county-by-county basis. It was very easy to imagine, and it would have been a morass, worse than Bush versus Gore.
That would have been ugly. We're going to talk about what's still needed to get the American voting system into shape, that is not such a threat. You can join the conversation tonight. Did you go into last week's vote afraid that polling failures could lead to a disputed outcome, to a crisis? And are you confident, as we talk tonight, in America's polling system? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the integrity of last week's presidential polling and the health of the American voting system. You can join the conversation tonight. If the vote had been closer last week, would we still be fighting about its legitimacy tonight? Are you confident last week's vote was legitimate? And after the fiasco of the 2000 election, why haven't we seen more thorough reform of the American voting system? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by Harvard Law School's Heather Gerken, by Stephen Ansola-Behir, co-director of the Caltech MIT Voter Technology Project. And I'm joined on the phone right now from Montpelier, Vermont, by Tom Hartman. He's a reporter and nationally syndicated radio show host, author of What Would Jefferson Do? He's been doing some pretty hot reporting about the complaints that remain about last week's vote. Tom Hartman, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. Hi.
Tom, we're hearing from all sides, and again here tonight, that for all the complaints, last week's vote was legitimate. George Bush was indeed the winner. We don't have to worry about it. And yet the Internet is full of contrary claims. Why is that? Is this just sour grapes or something else?
No, I think it goes much deeper than that. 6 years ago, you could have gotten 50 analysts together, stock analysts together, and said, is Enron a solid corporation? Are you 100% confident that Enron's, you know, doing the right thing, that they're making money, that they're, you know, well run? And they all would have said yes. We have Enron elections right now. There are private for-profit corporations in between you when you vote and the government when the vote is delivered to the government or to us, to we the people, and said, here it is. The government is the ultimate commons. You know, there is this collection of the commons, the air we breathe, the road system, the air traffic system, the police departments, the fire departments, the military. Mm. And that commons is regulated by the commons of the government, which we own. That's the unique, you know, that was the unique American experiment.
Yeah.
And the way that we administer that commons that we own is through our vote, right? Through elected representatives.
Of course, sure.
And now we have inserted in between us and the commons of the government private corporations. And
what are you talking about there? The Enron elections, that's a pretty big claim. Who are the private players that you're saying are the middlemen now?
Diebold and ES&S primarily. There are several other players.
So manufacturers of electronic voting systems.
Well, and yes, although in most cases the individual jurisdictions actually buy the machines, but the manufacturers continue to control the software, and they tell us, you may not look at this software. You may not see how this vote is processed. It may be that 100 votes are collected here, and we're telling you that there's 100 votes. Or maybe that there's 100 votes collected here. We're telling you there's 110.
I want to get the implication of what you're suggesting here, then, is the other complaints, this whole litany of things we've heard from Cuyahoga County in Ohio and the different counts in Florida and the exit polls versus voting tallies nationwide, you're pushing those to the side and focusing on the kind of black box of electronic voting. Is that your major or your only concern, Tom Hartman?
Well, no, there are a whole variety of concerns, clearly. You know, Greg Palast raised some, I think, pretty legitimate ones about the fact that in minority communities, for example, there's a long history of disenfranchisement by, you know, tossing in the worst machines, the things that are going to break down, small numbers of machines in areas that were going to be heavily Democratic, things like that, or Republican for that matter, if you want to go back 30, 40 years, 50 years. There was a paper published just today by Dr. Stephen Freeman at the University of Pennsylvania looking at the likelihood that the outcome of the exit polls was actually accurate. And just to quickly quote three sentences from it. Turns out that the likelihood, he's looking at Ohio, he says the likelihood was 1 in 1,000. Florida, the likelihood was 3 in 1,000. The likelihood of any two of these statistical anomalies occurring together is in the order of 1 in 1,000,000.
1 in 1,000,000 that the exit polls and the actual tally would be so different, you're saying.
Yeah, and then he says the odds against all three, this is if include Pennsylvania, occurring together are 250 million to one.
But then we have to believe there's some huge conspiracy theory to suppress the election, the exit polls.
Not necessarily. I mean, it could simply be things aren't working right. The point is there's no transparency in the system. In virtually every other country in the world, the system is completely transparent. I lived in Germany for a year back, 86, 87. Mm-hmm. In Germany, when they do the elections, you literally mark it on a piece of paper, and for a week or so, civil servants with, you know, political volunteers standing around monitoring mark it down in books, and they add these things up, and there is no question about it. And the night of the election, the night that the election is finished, Deutsche Welle and the other, you know, German news media announced the results of the election. and they have never been more than 1% off since essentially World War II, and they do it based on exit polls. Exit polls are the gold standard by which we certify the validity of elections all over the world. And the vast majority of you know, fully realized democracies in the world are not inserting proprietary corporate software between the voters and the ultimate outcome of the vote.
Okay, Tom Harper, stand by. I want to get Heather Gherkin in here. Heather, you hear the sort of the large claim here, Enron elections, the concern about electronic voting machines, a concern about a lack of transparency. I want to hold that up against your top list of systemic problems in the system right now that you're worried may be giving problems to our outcome.
So I'm concerned about some of these issues, although I don't share all of Tom's views on these questions. But I will say that my biggest concern comes from an institutional perspective, which is we have the problem of the foxes guarding the hen house. The system is dominated by partisan officials from top to bottom. You remember Florida, Catherine Harris, Secretary of State, chair of the Bush campaign, the Attorney General, a Democrat, chair of the Gore campaign. Those were the two officials who are vested with the power to make important decisions about how our ballots counted. That is not a sensible system. We ought to have a system that's run independently with people whose jobs don't depend on the judgment on the calls that they make.
So that's the surrounding dynamic that nobody would like, but we've lived with that for a long time, and we haven't had the kind of Florida thing for crisis, debacle for a very long time. The level of unease with American presidential voting in particular seems higher than I can ever remember it now, and we've always had foxes guarding the hen house.
Well, this is the dark underside of American politics, is just elections aren't often that close. But Florida simply told us what people who ran elections knew for a long time, which is the system is not working very well, the machinery is not very good, there are a lot of problems with the system. It only runs into the crisis you see in Florida when the divisions are so tight in the state that you just don't get enough votes to
match.
But
foxes in there alone are not a problem if they don't do something wrong. What are the instruments, the flawed instruments you're seeing in the hands of the people who run the voting system?
There's so much room for judgment calls here, and many of these judgment calls are made after the election. So people know that when they count this provisional ballot, mm-hmm. it is going to help or hurt their preferred candidate.
Mm-hmm. So you can become more lenient or more stingy in interpreting it depending
exactly.
what the consequences
might
be.
So one step is, of course, to eliminate that discretion to the extent possible. But at some point, you're going to have to leave discretion to these folks, and you need to make sure the discretion is left in the hands of people whose jobs don't depend on the outcome of their judgment calls.
Getting those conflicts of interest resolved. I want to begin to bring our callers into this conversation. Let's turn to Greensboro, North Carolina. Juan is on the air. Hi, Juan.
Yeah, hi. I'm in North Carolina, and so we wasn't a close state, but it just shows the irregularities in Watauga County just show that the black box system doesn't work, and we need at least a paper trail with these boxes.
When you say black box, you mean electronic voting machines?
Yes. In Watauga County, they had the poll workers had been told by the manufacturers that it would hold 10,000 votes. But it actually only held 3,500, and around 4,500 votes were lost, and were lost for all eternity. And
let's just do a quick reality check on that. Hang with us, Juan. Stephen, an electronic voting machine that would only hold 10,000 votes, does that make sense? I mean, wouldn't software tally any number you put in?
Yeah, the equipment, it's a bit out of date even when it comes online, because it takes about a year to certify something and a year to develop it. So that by the time a piece of hardware is shipped off to a county, and it is sold county by county, a computer that's run is at least 2 years old.
And you can imagine a computer-based voting machine that could only hold 10,000 votes?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. Usually what happens is there's some requests for, say, additional language ballots or some other complication that leads to the propagation of more ballots, which takes more memory allocated.
So non-English ballots, in other words.
Yeah, and that's what happened, for example, in Miami-Dade in 2002. A lot of this is the equipment that's being sold is out of date. It doesn't have a lot of memory. It's old computers. So this is actually one of our complaints with the equipment that is being developed. And a lot of this isn't conspiratorial. It's just the competence and capacity of the software, the equipment manufacturing system, and the testing system. There is a testing system in place. the computer code is actually escrowed in 41 states. Not all the states buy into that inspection system. In most of these states, the code is inspected by computer scientists in those states or people who do this for a living.
I want to talk more about that, but Juan in Greensboro, let me just come to you. So we've got it from our MIT guy saying, yes, indeed, this could happen. You say it did happen in North Carolina. How are people responding to that?
Well, okay, and you got it a bit wrong there, Tom.
Sorry.
It only held 3,500 votes. They were told it would hold 10,000, so
right.
We lost 4,500. But I want to go back to the fact that if we just had a receipt, if we just had two receipts, one for us and one for the poll workers, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
And who wouldn't want to have that? Juan, thanks very much for your call. Stephen, I want to turn to this issue then. Number one, why is there not a paper trail with these electronic voting machines? And
Juan said something different, which is have a receipt, one for us, one for the.
What's the difference? Isn't a receipt paper?
Well, that's quite a different thing, because then that becomes currency. And one of the things we see with absentee balloting around the country is cases of voter fraud where voters sell their ballots.
Let's see. So, in other words, I would walk out of the voting place with a receipt showing how I voted, and so then I could have $100 laid in my palm or whatever.
As soon as secrecy is violated, and that's technically and intellectually the difficult problem here, which is how do you create a receipt-free, secure electronic system?
Even if the voter isn't given the receipt,
right.
If there's any receipt created, somebody can track how they voted. Is that
right.
What you're saying?
If you do electronic banking, you might be encountering the same problem because there's no receipt there except what the bank gives you. But if you're completely an online banker, there's no receipt. It's just whatever goes into the ether.
Why not just have a paper record of each vote kind of come out the back of the machine and drop in a box as if the voter had put it in there? So I've got a box full of...
That's an optical scanner. We have that.
Well, why not? But we don't have it everywhere, clearly. We don't have a paper record of all votes.
That's what we recommended after the 2000 election. And about 40%, a little under 40% of the counties of the votes cast this last time were on that system. Punch cards are the same way. Some of this has to do with a legacy of who adopted lever machines in the 1920s. And lever machines came in to combat fraud. Lever machine weighs 900 pounds. It's not going to show up in the river. Ballot boxes showed up in the river.
And that was the problem. Heather Gerken, jump in here. I just hear more and more people worried about the idea, given how contentious politics have become, how close so many races are, more and more uncomfortable with the idea of just touching a screen and a digital impulse going off into the ether without a record of it. And yet, as Stephen says, you've got this patchwork of different generations of machines. Is it time, is it feasible to kind of wipe the slate clean nationwide, come up with an optimal system, whatever it is, require every county and every voting district to adopt it, and 4 years from now, or eight if it takes longer, have an undeniably credible voting system?
It will take a little bit more than that to get there, but certainly that's absolutely the first start. I mean, what Juan is touching on, I think, is the sort of problem about elections generally, which is not just that fairness matters, the appearance of fairness matters. People have to trust the system. And it's obvious now that people need the reassurance of a paper ballot or some sort of record other than what's in the Ethernet in order to feel like they trust the system. So that would certainly be a huge step in the right direction.
What you're suggesting, Tom, is effectively what Brazil did 10 years ago. Brazil had hand-counted paper. People were called to count the paper as if by jury duty.
Right.
And a lot of ballots got thrown away by the people who were counting the votes.
Yep.
Brazil realized that this was a threat to their democracy. They set up a national institution. They said, okay, here are 15 criteria. Whatever machine meets these criteria, we're going to adopt.
Yep.
We're going to choose among them. Interestingly enough, all of the big computer firms in the United States got involved in this. HP, IBM, Unisys. None of them vend in the United States.
None of
them vend voting machines in the United States.
So why would they do it in Brazil? Why don't they do it here?
Because they get one big contract. There's an economy of scale. The way the U.S. works is every county or in New England, every town buys their own equipment, and that's a really bad business model. And I think what's really makes this rickety is having county-level administration. If you centralized even to the level of a state, and many states are doing this now, they're centralizing to the level of the state,
right.
Maryland, Georgia, Delaware.
Then you've got some big contracts.
Then you've got big contracts. You can specify, you know, it has to be disabilities accessible. It has to be, you know, accessible to go into certain kinds of polling places. It has to have a paper trail and so forth. And then you can let the firms build to those specifications.
It doesn't get a lot worse, though, than 2000, and it hasn't happened nationwide or in many states since then. Heather Gerken, if it hasn't happened in this period, what's going to make it happen?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit sad. I mean, basically, the reason it didn't happen was because of partisan bickering in Washington. The Republicans took every effort at reform as an attack on Bush's legitimacy. The Democrats didn't want to undermine that view because, of course, they did want to attack Bush's legitimacy. What we need is for one party or the other to give a little bit and to recognize that there's something bigger here than the interests of the parties. They really are going to have to sort of take into account what Brazil did, which is that the health of our democracy in the long term depends on what they do in the next 4 years.
Tom Hartmann, you leave us with this kind of eerie phrase, Enron elections. What do you see as the path to a solution here?
Well, I think it's fascinating. Now, almost 2 years ago, Congressman Rush Holt introduced a piece of legislation into Congress. There's a similar bill in the Senate co-sponsored by Hillary Clinton that would have required a voter-verified ballot, which is one of the things that wasn't mentioned, which is where you vote on the machine produces a piece of paper. That piece of paper actually is your ballot. Mm. You look at it and make sure that it says what you put into the machine, mm-hmm. and then you toss it in the box. The machine's actually doing the tabulating, but if there's ever a requirement for a recount, there's the ballot. And, in fact, you do random audits and you pull out the ballots. This bill was so resisted by the Republicans in the House that Denny Hastert and Tom DeLay wouldn't even allow it to come to committee vote. And there's a lot of people wondering why. Why for a year and a half did the Republicans work so hard to prevent any sort of paper trail, any sort of verification, any sort of transparency, particularly the random audit, this 0.1% random audit provision seemed to be a real sticker. A big question. And then today you've got Ed Gillespie in the National Press Club coming out and saying, you know, we really ought to do away with exit polls.
This is the head of the Democratic National Committee.
Yeah, the former Enron lobbyist, who's the head of the Democratic National Committee, before he became head of the DNC, is making $700,000 a year as an Enron lobbyist. And you add these two things together, and I realize that sounds partisan. Perhaps I am. But in any case, you add those two things together, and I think a lot of folks who are not Republicans are looking at this going, what's up with these people? Is this about single party rule? I mean, and that's really, you know, kind of getting into the realm of tinfoil hats, you know, conspiracy theorist stuff. But it's like, why not? Why not have a system that is accountable? And frankly, as I said before, I would take it even a step further and say that the source code should be open source code. It should be freely and publicly available. And the system should be operating with complete transparency. There should not be trade secrets or corporations claiming Fourth Amendment rights or privacy in the middle of this process.
Tom Hartmann, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Sure.
Tom Hartmann, reporter and nationally syndicated radio show host, and of course he was talking about Republican National Committee there. Wow, we've got a lot to sort out. Heather Gerken, Stephen and Sullivan here. We'll be right back. We're talking about the integrity of last week's presidential polling. You can join the conversation. Shouldn't the United States of America be able to mount unquestionably fair and clean elections? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the integrity of last week's presidential polling and the health of the American voting system. My guests tonight, Stephen Ansola-Bahir, he's co-director of the Caltech MIT Voter Technology Project, and Heather Gerken at Harvard Law School, who says we dodged a bullet last week with a margin of victory large enough for George Bush that all these problems are not being contested, are not being fully brought into play, but it is a bullet that we dodged. You can join this conversation. What kind of crisis are we flirting with if Americans can't or don't trust their own elections? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Sam is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Hi. I build databases is what I do, and I don't understand why we can't have this be, you know, effectively a perfect system. We have banks that don't make mistakes or make very, very few compared to what we're seeing with this election. You know, we should, as Tom was saying, open source the software, because then there's a check on it as opposed to having it be proprietary and somebody own it. And it's very, very easy to write software that does whatever you want it to. correctly or conflicts incorrectly.
We've got it, Sam. You're in the business, and you say, why not have a system that does it perfectly? Stephen, I want to clarify this. Tom Hartman was saying, let's have open source code. You were saying the code is now escrowed. We better clarify some terms here. What does that mean?
There's a big range of what open source means. What currently exists in 41 states that buy into the voluntary system standards is the code for any machine is given over to the state and escrowed so that if there is a problem, it can be inspected. It's inspected by computer scientists before, as part of the purchasing and certification process in the 41 states that buy into these standards.
But it's kind of open, but open only to the states if they look sequestered.
And I think there's a lot of debate right now, and has been for the last 4 years, about how much farther to go. And you know, code checking, as you know, is a very difficult thing, and there's a sense in which there needs to be more code checking. The kinds of things that are detected by people like Avi Rubin at Johns Hopkins are, you know, sloppiness in the code, things that should have been cleaned up and so forth. And a lot of what happens in the certification process is a computer scientist like Doug Jones at Iowa or Michael Shamus at Carnegie Mellon, these are people who do this kind of work, will find things and they'll request that the firms fix problems in the code.
But those are flaws, and that's bad enough. You know what really gets people staying awake at night is the idea of manipulable electronic results. What's the margin of possibility for that in this current mishmash of systems?
Well, one thing that is a protection is this is true with hand-counted paper, because you can always manipulate hand-counted paper, and there's a big bad history with that in the United States. Is just the decentralization. And to some extent, the pushback from the Republicans on the Help America Vote Act was decentralization is what keeps this from being manipulated centrally.
If you put it through all through one funnel, it can all be massaged in one funnel.
Exactly. The machines are standalone machines. They're not hooked up to the internet as they operate. Mm-hmm. And so that means that some, you know, kid can't hack into them while they're operating.
Lex Luthor is not sitting somewhere.
But there are points of vulnerability, and these are things that people are continually pushing on and trying to improve. The other issue that was raised was, well, why can't we just sort of write the right code? Mm-hmm. And why isn't this like banking? It's not like banking because, except for purely electronic banking, which has a lot of vulnerabilities and problems right now, there are no receipts. The check on banking is, and why the errors are so low, is that the customer
that receipt, and many hold on to it.
Gets the receipt, and errors are made, and you go and you square them with the bank. You can't do that because as soon as you do that with a vote, it becomes currency. People sell it. People coerce you.
Jason's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hi there. I wanted to say that I think everybody is missing a major point of this, and that's the long, long lines that people were faced with in this election.
Yeah.
And I want to say that if I was going to go face a six-hour line, I would not go and vote. Now, I love our democracy as much as anybody else, but I think it's unreasonable to ask people to wait for 6 hours. And in one place in Ohio, I read on an internet site today, as much as 9 hours waiting to vote.
That is crazy.
Has it always been like this? Because, I'm only 24. I haven't seen previous elections, but I can't imagine that it's been like this all the time. And I think that the election wasn't stolen, that people are missing the point when they say that it wasn't stolen. I don't believe that. Mm. I believe that this was incompetently managed on a gigantic scale, and that we really need a revote in places where the voting was that long. Because think about it, people who have jobs or have families to take care of.
Oh, sure, they're going to be turned away. Nobody can wait 6 hours, let alone 9. Jason, thanks for your call. Heather Gerken, what about this issue of simply poorly managed voting, if that's the right phrase for it, those long lines, a factor, a major factor?
Well, I think he's absolutely right that the election was poorly managed. There's just not enough money in the system to help adequately train and staff these institutions.
But do those long lines show up randomly, or are they in a certain sort of community?
Well, you know, the suspicion initially was that they were a certain sort of community, but then you start getting more information, it starts looking like, in fact, there were a lot of places.
So even in country club neighborhoods, they waited 6 hours in line?
I live in a country club neighborhood, and I sat in line for about an hour waiting for it to cast my vote, which is sort of unheard of in a place where your vote, in fact, doesn't count, such as Massachusetts. But just to get back, what I really appreciate about Jason's comment is this. What he's saying is, look, we're not going to indulge in some sort of conspiracy theory. We don't need to have the Twilight Zone playing in the background trying to draw inferences, as I think Tom Hartman is doing improperly, about what look pretty much to the rest of us like everyday politics. Politicians never have an incentive to change the system by which they were elected. Jason's point, though, is, look, if we care about a democracy, if we care care about the right to vote. We ought to take these problems seriously. And we can take these problems seriously without adding in the accusation that the election was stolen. We can simply say, these are problems. We care about our democracy. Let's get our hands dirty and try to fix them.
Is there still a national mechanism in place, Heather, that's working toward that? Or not? Is it, there was a process after 2000. Is there now to make it better, to reform?
It's the same problem as we had in 2000, which is that there are a lot of self-interested politicians who have no incentive to do this unless voters like Jason put their feet to the fire. And the only possibility I can think of is that if the Republicans are really expecting a 20-year or 30-year reign, then they might think it's in their self-interest to do the following, which is a mandate doesn't matter if people don't believe you actually earned it. Mm. And so there may be some odd incentive for the Republican Party now to think more seriously about electoral reform, because if they really do think they can beat the Democrats in every
year
election,
after year, this is the time.
Then this is the time for them to fix the election system, because at least the Democrats will believe they got beaten than to have folks like Tom Hartman and others circulating theories that seem plausible initially, but really undermine sort of the foundations of our democratic system.
But the demand, even in those kind of theories, is essentially, let's get this right. We don't deserve to have this level
exactly.
of uncertainty.
And let's get it right, not because we think the vote was stolen, but because we actually care about the
vote. It's sacred. It's democracy. It's what everything's built on.
Exactly.
Heather Gerken, Assistant Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
It's nice to be here.
And Stephen Ansola-Bahir, Professor of Political Science at MIT and co-director of the Caltech MIT Voter Technology Project. Wonderful to have you. Thanks for being with us. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, last letters home from soldiers in Iraq. This is On Point. More than 1,100 American soldiers have now died in Iraq, including at least 18 this week during the battle for Fallujah. That means thousands of family members left without a loved one, with only memories, snapshots, a folded flag, and for some, last letters from the front. Last year, the New York Times began publishing letters written by soldiers in Iraq shortly before they were killed. The letters offer an intimate look into the minds of the soldiers putting their lives on the line in Iraq. Some express hope of coming home soon. Some are filled with worry. Life Books has compiled the letters in a new collection entitled Last Letters Home, Voices of Americans from the Battlefields of Iraq. Tonight, HBO will air a documentary based on the collection. Bob Sullivan edited the collection of letters for Life Books. Tonight, in honor of Veterans Day, he reads some of the last letters written home from American soldiers who have died in Iraq.
This first letter I'll read is from Captain Joshua Byers, the U.S. Army. Captain Byers got out of West Point, he married, he ended up in Iraq, and he was doing what he always dreamed of doing. He was commanding. He talks about just how much that meant to him. And this letter that I'm going to read from Captain Byers was written to his parents. Dear Mom and Dad, life here continues to be challenging, but we're all hanging in there. We got a blow to our morale a few days ago when the Corps commander visited us. He said there was no way we were going home in less than 9 to 12 months. We're working on month number 4 right now, and it already seems like we've been here forever and a day. We're supposed to start transitioning to engagement with the local populace, or winning hearts and minds work. So far, they've only seen the tough, aggressive side of us. Now we're supposed to go out and give them school supplies, clothes, sports equipment, help restore electricity, purify water, etc. I'll be going out this morning with a bunch of soccer balls to give to the kids. We conducted a raid on an Islamic extremist's house a few days ago. I was wrapped up in the situation. I looked across the lawn and saw one of my soldiers calming down a little girl, probably 2 or 3 years old, cute as a button, and crying her head off, as you can imagine. We got one candy bar a week on average, and he was giving her his candy bar, feeding it to her a piece at a time until she stopped crying. He did that just moments after being shot at and shooting men in this girl's house, probably her dad and brothers, cousins. It really touched me. Love, JT. Captain Byers, on July 23, 2003, was the 29-year-old commander of Fox Troop, a unit of 100 soldiers riding Bradley fighting vehicles and other tanks. On that day, which was only 40 days before Byers' dream of commanding a troop came true, he and his unit were attacked while traveling not far from Baghdad in a convoy of about 50 vehicles. Two men detonated an explosive device right next to Byers' Humvee, killing him instantly. Private First Class Jesse Givens was a soldier in the Army. He was married to Melissa. They had a son, Dakota, and when he was deployed to Iraq, she was pregnant with what would be their second son, now named Carson. In the letter that I'm about to read, Carson is known as Bean. Givens had a sense of foreboding almost from the moment he stepped foot in Iraq. The foreboding would be concluded when an embankment gave way and his tank went to the bottom of a river and he drowned. Before he did, he wrote a long letter to his family, and he asked Melissa not to open it unless he was killed. "My family, I never thought that I would be writing a letter like this. I really don't know where to start. I've been getting bad feelings, though, and, well, if you are reading this, Dakota, you are more son than I could ever ask for. I can only hope I was half the dad. I used to be your Danny, but no matter what, it makes me proud that you chose me. You taught me how to care until it hurts. You taught me that life isn't so serious and sometimes you have to play. You have a big and beautiful heart. Through life, you need to keep it open and follow it. Never be afraid to be yourself. I will always be there in our park when you dream so that we can still play. I hope someday you will have a son just like mine. Make them smile and shine just like you. I love you, Toad. I hope someday you will understand why I didn't come home. Please be proud of me. Please don't stop loving life. Take in every breath like it's your first. I love you, Toad. I will always be there with you. I'll be in the sun, shadows, dreams, and joys of your life. Bean, I never got to see you, but I know in my heart that you are beautiful. I know you will be strong and big-hearted, just like your mom and brother. I'll always have with me the feel of the soft nudges of your mom's belly and the joy I felt when we found out that you were on your way. I dream of you every night. I will always. Don't ever think that since I wasn't around that I didn't love you. You were conceived of love, and I came to this terrible place for love. I love you as I do your mom and brother with all my heart and soul. Please understand that I had to be gone so that I could take care of my family. I love you, Bean. I have never been so blessed as the day I met Melissa Dawn Benfield. You are my angel, soulmate, wife, lover, and best friend. I am sorry. I did not want to have to write this letter. There is so much more I need to say, so much more I need to share, a lifetime's worth. I married you for a million lifetimes. That's how long I will be with you. Do me a favor. After you tuck Toad and Bean in, give them hugs and kisses from me. Go outside, look at the stars and count them. Don't forget to smile. Love always. Your husband, Jess."
Bob Sullivan is editor of Last Letters Home, Voices of Americans from the Battlefields of Iraq, published by Life Books, Voices of Soldiers Who Will Not Come Home. HBO is airing a documentary based on the Last Letters Home collection at 9 p.m. Eastern tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.